From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just over 2 years ago when Rochester was in the throes of another brutal winter. Yana Cashbur and Sean Smith were feeling like, I think a lot of people were feeling that winter, maybe isolated, stuck indoors, restless, but they had a more complicated problem. They were in recovery from addiction and worried that without more physical activity, they'd be more vulnerable. And so they posted on their personal Facebook pages, advertising just a hike. About a dozen people joined them, and the next weekend they did the same thing, and those hikes became regular events. Almost by accident, they had created a community, and that community evolved to become Rockcovery Fitness. Well, today they've reached nearly 1,000 people, helping them out recovering from addiction, and next week they cut the ribbon on their new facility, formerly a firehouse that is being renovated on Dewey Avenue. Now, unfortunately, there are more potential community members than ever who can use the help of Rockcovery. We know addiction is growing as a problem, particularly when it comes to heroin and opioids, but what remarkable work they're doing. Our guests have personal stories to share, as well as their own ideas about how to deal with the addiction crisis in our community, and they've got a lot to tell you about what's coming up on Monday. They are very excited to share, so let me welcome them now. Yana Cashbur is the CEO and co-founder of Rockcovery Fitness. Congratulations on all of this, Yana. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Sean Smith is a co-founder of Rockcovery Fitness as well. Sean, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
Tad McNulty is a Rockcovery member, and Tad, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Maribeth Nally is the mother of two sons in recovery and has gotten to know this crew pretty well, too. Maribeth, welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much, Evan.
May 1st, that is Monday, and that is finally here, Yana. So does it feel surreal that you got this facility finally opening?
It absolutely does. We're definitely in a crunch time, but it's always just mind-blowing how much support we have and how people come together to help the recovery community as a whole.
Well, let's go back a couple of years when everything kind of was starting here. And so how exactly did that first hike come about? I mean, tell me about the conversations and what was going on then.
Really, that hike was very much by accident, and it did come from a place of disease. We were isolating, like you mentioned. We were isolating, and we were pulling away from the recovery community, not doing the things we need to do to really feed our recovery. And we were at the brink of relapse. We got so close. It was either to pick up drugs and alcohol or do something different. And that's really how it started. We decided to post this hike just really out of desperation in many ways.
Almost a way to kind of declare you're going to choose something different and almost make that a public choice?
Yeah, to keep ourselves accountable. Because if we have a place that we have to be, and even now with Rockcovery, we have a commitment to our members. So we had a commitment to our friends to be at this hike, which meant that we had to be there.
And so your own personal story, to the extent that you can share it, Yana, is what in recovery and addiction?
I am in recovery for 3 years, and that is, I have not had a drink or a drug consistently for 3 years, or continuously for 3 years. Mm-hmm. My addiction started pretty early, which is probably the story of many folks, at around 12 years old.
12?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I started using drugs and alcohol, and it just progressed, you know, slowly but surely. And I was, you know, kind of like the girl next door. I went to school. I got good grades.
Around here, where'd you go to school?
In Staten Island, New York City area. I stayed out of trouble. You know, I did those things that on the outside appear to be what most people were doing at that time. And somewhere along the road, as it does for many, it just took over my life. And I could no longer try to even cover up or try to pretend like I was living a normal life.
What kind of drugs were you doing in those middle school years?
Middle school was alcohol, marijuana, hallucinogenics. That was middle school. And by college, I would say 18, 19, it progressed to cocaine and opioid pills.
Mm-hmm. And those early years, was it peer pressure? Do you remember why you started?
I was someone that was sort of teased in school, and I didn't really fit in much. And I just wanted to fit in with the crowd. And I saw some of the, you know, more popular kids, quote unquote, drinking and doing these things. And I just wanted to give it a try. And I was also just very anxious and very sort of nervous. You go through those teenage years, and I did not have the tools to cope with the feelings, with just life, so to speak. So drugs and alcohol really eased that pain and discomfort and maybe made me a little more comfortable in my skin.
Was there a moment, either in your teen years, maybe into college or later, where you thought, I am addicted. I cannot stop. I don't have control over this.
Not until I entered recovery.
Wow.
It was almost like my brain tricked me into thinking that I could stop when I wanted to. And I remember the whole time I said I could stop when I wanted, when I want to. This thing doesn't have a hold of me. Realizing on some levels that my drinking and drugging was not normal, but it was almost like a fog.
And, you know, so forgive my ignorance about this, but even with cocaine, you really thought, I don't have to do this. I can stop. Mm-hmm. Even with opioids.
Yeah, it seemed like so many people around me were doing those same things. And on the outside, I held a job. I was, and before that, I was going to school. I had a graduate degree. So I thought, because I'm having all these accomplishments, because I'm doing all these good things, I can't possibly have a problem.
Were you spending a lot of money on drugs?
I was.
Yeah. And did that get more difficult to chase?
It did, because it came to a point where it was no longer enjoyable. And even though I didn't think that I had a problem, I couldn't stop. And I just needed it to get by day to day.
Okay. And so you have been 3 years in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But what pushed you into recovery? What changed for you?
Legal consequences. I had a number of drunk driving arrests over a short period of time, and it forced me to... I wouldn't even say I didn't even understand then that I had a problem, but it forced me to seek help just by the courts, by the legal system. And really, I believe the police officers, the criminal justice system saved my life.
Okay. But you still had to kind of embrace the idea of recovery, or at least I would think. I mean, many of the stories I hear sound pretty similar in that, you know, until you're really kind of ready to embrace the effort, it's difficult. Was that true for you?
Yeah. Yeah. And at that point, that last year, every day I woke up and I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't want to continue in just the depression and the misery. But I didn't know what was wrong. I kind of just thought I was doomed.
And so now three years for you, and how do you feel? How are you today?
I feel great. You know, I experience life in a way that I never have. I have fun in ways that I never imagined. It's really a dream, and it's a second chance, and very few people get to have those second chances to live life again.
I mean, getting ready for this program, talking to people like Maribeth and a few others, Jana's amazing. You know, I mean, just it's a really neat thing to see how much admiration you have in the community. And so that's Jana's story. Before we get into the story of the actual building of Rockcovery and then, you know, all the nitty gritty becoming the business and doing all the stuff. Let me ask Sean, you're celebrating 3 years on launch day, on cutting the ribbon day next Monday.
It just turned out to be that way.
May 1st.
May 1st, 3
wow,
years.
Wow. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
So take me back a little bit for your own story.
You know, my drinking started, you know, I had my first drink at 12, but wouldn't say I was addicted at 12. Probably, you know, 16, 17 years old, that first drunk, I knew that's exactly how I wanted to feel each and every weekend, you know? And much like Jana, I had that disease, that uncomfortability around people. And I knew that alcohol would ease, you know, some of that anxiety in social situations. So, you know, at any opportunity, I made sure that I had some alcohol in me or alcohol close by so that I could feel normal. And what that turned into, you know, down the road was me being a daily drinker by the time I was probably 20. You know, it is progressive. And I noticed that I was drinking too much.
What were you drinking?
Back then it was just beer, some hard liquor, but mostly beer. But towards the end it was vodka, you know, morning, noon, and night. You know, I joined the military with the hopes that it would curb some of my drinking, give me some of the discipline, because I realized that I was partying just a little too hard. And I wanted to get my life in order. I wanted to go back to school, and start, you know, a real job and a career, and I understood that booze was kind of getting in the way. So I joined the military, did my 40.
What age, by the way?
I was 21 when I joined.
Okay.
So, but what I didn't realize was I was joining one of the largest fraternities in the world, where they kind of teach you how to drink in the barracks, you know? So I get through basic training, I go all that time clean, and as soon as I report to my duty station, I find guys who drink like me. And that's what alcoholics do. They surround themselves with someone who drinks at least as much as them, if not more, so that they feel good about the way that they're drinking.
Okay, and so what happened next for you?
So I got out, and I did start going to school again. Mm-hmm. And I made it a priority to keep the drinking to weekends. But as a true alcoholic, you know, I couldn't do that. It crept into the work week.
Were you sneaking it?
Eventually I was, yeah. My fiance at the time, you know, she gave me an ultimatum. She said, you either, you know, go to counseling for this or I'm leaving. I said, well, you better leave because I'm not going to counseling. And so it did take off. She left and it took off, and I quickly became a daily drinker. By the time I was about 30, I was hitting it real hard. And it took a couple years before I could actually ask for help. And much like Yana, it was that fog. And it wasn't really me asking for help. It was more so my family and friends saying, Sean, you need to do something about this. You know, you're drinking in your basement so no one can find you. You know, you wake up and you put booze in you immediately and you stay drunk all day. That was my MO. You know, I lost my fiance, lost my job, lost my house. Just, you know, in quick succession, I started rapidly losing everything in my life.
And I know you're hearing at that point from family, but are you accepting that that was a problem, or are you still in denial about it?
I was starting to. Okay. I was still in somewhat of denial because I wanted to keep going, because it was the only thing that would ease some of that anxiety, depression at this point. I was deeply depressed, and a lot like Yana, I didn't want to live like that anymore. And it was tough to admit that I needed help. Because in the military, you're taught, you know, you can endure this, you adapt, you overcome. And I didn't know what that looked like, but I do now. That adaptation was recovery. I didn't know it back then. And, you know, embedding myself into the recovery community and taking the action steps necessary to make sure that I'm living healthy, you know, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. Make sure that I get to the next day clean and sober.
So you've got 3 years coming up.
3 years, yeah.
And do you think about taking a drink? Does it come into your mind after 3 years?
The thought, you know, if at all, it's fleeting. As long as I stay connected, it's so important that I stay connected to people in recovery, that I'm reaching out to other people to try to help them. And just sharing my story really helps, you know. Being vocal with our recovery, people come to us and say thank you for saying what you do, because a lot of people keep it to themselves, and you don't know that a lot of people are in recovery. And I feel like if more people came out openly with their recovery story, it has power, and it draws those people who truly need it to you.
Don't you think that when you think about the military ethos, that, you know, you can endure, that you can handle this, part of enduring for someone in who is addicted, getting into recovery, showing strength, is asking for help, isn't it?
It's exactly it, yeah. And, that, you know, a lot of, especially males, feel like it's a weakness, especially in the military. So I work at the Veterans Outreach Center, and a lot of the guys that I work with won't, you know, reach out their hand for help. Won't say that they're struggling, because they want this appearance of, I am strong, you know, I'm a warrior. But in the end, with this disease, you have to admit that it's stronger than you are. It truly is. I can't win that battle alone. And that's why I need people like Yana, people like Tad, people like Maribeth to help me day to day. If I am struggling, if I do have that fleeting thought, I can go to them and talk about it.
So it was a couple of years ago that you guys are both, you know, into your first year of recovery. But, Yana, were you both, as you said, kind of worried that, especially in that isolating kind of winter, you were worried about what might happen next?
Absolutely. I think, and I could remember kind of vividly, we would discuss wanting to drink so bad, and it becomes this overpowering urge that's all you could think about, and I was just obsessing, and I couldn't shake the thought, and I I could almost feel it in my veins. My body was craving drugs and alcohol. Because I got so disconnected from the recovery community, that we come together, you know, it's this shared experience. And it's someone that hasn't been affected, doesn't quite know how that feels, but someone that has the disease of addiction will be able to say, yeah, I get that. And this is what I did.
Sean, how are you feeling at that time?
At that time, a lot like Yana, very stir crazy, some cabin fever, maybe some seasonal depression creeping in. I knew I had to get out and move, and that's actually one of our taglines now, is just wake up and move. And it's so important for me now. And I kind of knew it back then, but really what started as a fitness thing, getting out and moving, has turned into more of a human connection thing. You know.
Oh, one of the really cool taglines, too, that I'm looking at Sean's shirt, Sober Living Through Fitness. It's a great tagline. Sean is living that. He looks like he was cut from a block of granite. and now I want to know, you know, when you guys got started with this, was it like 8 degrees when you hiked? I mean, like, it was, that winter was brutal. Where did you go? What did you do?
That February was so cold.
It was,
and that
awful.
First hike was awful. Actually, it was a lot of fun. You know, we complained and laughed at the same time about how cold it was and what trail we were on, and we were completely lost in Tryon Park.
Tryon Park?
and we found our way out of the park together. And it's a lot like recovery, you know. You find a group of people that are, you know, kind of lost. And together we can find our way out of this thing.
And so a few days later, it's like, well, let's do this again? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we started adding more and more events. You know, we started adding, you know, high-intensity park workouts, all sorts of things, rappelling, a lot of adventure fitness. You know, we tried to go up to the Adirondacks once a month to go and climb one of the high peaks.
We go kayaking, bike rides, anything you could think of. Yeah. We go to the trampoline park for some workouts they have there. So it's anything to do with getting out, getting connected, engaging your body and your mind.
And so this all started in February 2015. At what point did you guys realize this is not just a group of people in recovery hanging out, having fun, using fitness as a way to stay focused on recovery, that we've got something that we can create? When did you say... You know, who came up with the name Rockcovery, which I love, by the way? When did that all happen?
We went through a series of names pretty quickly, and we couldn't really pick one.
What was the worst one? Come on.
Probably the one that we wanted to go with, and it was called Refit Rock.
There's nothing wrong with
Recovery
that.
Fitness Rochester is what
it's pretty
stood
good.
For. Doesn't have the ring that Rockcovery does.
So how did Rockcovery come out?
We took a poll of our participants because we were just, I don't know, I'm not terribly creative. And we just asked our participants what they thought of names, and people threw out ideas, and it was on Facebook, and you know, people like different ideas, and this one idea had the most likes. So we went with it.
That's a great name. And by what, September, you were kind of doing the legal work to become a thing, you know, is that what happened?
Yeah, we were incorporated September 10th of 2015. And but before that, over that summer was when we started to look more into creating something more than just kind of people getting together. And we learned about Phoenix Multisport in Colorado. And we learned about their founder, Scott Strode, who was really for the past, at that point, I guess it was 8 years, doing exactly what we wanted to do. And that was creating a peer-led, sober, active community. And he was having tremendous success and just... they're an incredible organization. I can't say enough about them. And we reached out to them, and we literally mimic their programs and what they do. And they mentor us, and they help us grow, and they help us get through challenges. They've been so supportive.
Monday is a big day. May 1st mm-hmm. is the grand opening and ribbon-cutting ceremony for the new facility for Rockcovery Fitness. You've got an event at 11 a.m., 5 p.m. Why don't you tell us about what's coming up and tell people the location. Let's let the community know everything they need to know about Rockcovery.
Yeah. So this incredible firehouse, and it was built in 1910. It's an absolutely amazing building. Is located on 1035 Dewey Avenue, not far from Aquinas. And we will be having our ribbon cutting ceremony on May 1st, 11 o'clock. And it's going to include just the community coming together. We're going to have snacks and refreshments and give tours and tell a little bit of history about the building and some history or some statistics about recovery and the power of recovery. And then later that day at 5 o'clock, we are having just a very happy social get-together and a cookout because one of our friends volunteered to cater this event for us.
We're going to hear Tad's story as a member, and Mary Beth, who has a couple of sons I know are in recovery. And we're going to hear their stories in our second half hour, but I want to make sure people understand really who Rockcovery is aimed at and then what the facility is like now. So, John, Yana, can you tell us a little bit more about what they're going to find when they go to the facility at Dewey?
Sure. It's a huge space, 8,900 square feet. We have several rooms. The one you walk in initially, that'll be our sober clubhouse. So, you know, movie night, coffee, there, you know, throughout the day, more like a lounge atmosphere where people can just come in and hang out and talk.
And also help them through some of those triggering events like sober Super Bowls, New Year's Eve, 4th of July, things that could really be hard for some folks to get through.
What a good point. And you know what? What a good point that a lot of people would take for granted if they're not in the recovery community. Great point. Okay, so take us to the rest of the facility, Sean.
So Phoenix Multisport was so gracious to donate us some Rogue workout equipment, and it's going to outfit our CrossFit gym, our CrossFit-style gym. We'll be offering high-intensity classes in it. We'll also have a conventional gym in there as well with dumbbells and the normal weights you see at gyms. We have cardio equipment. Norris donated some ellipticals and recumbent bikes. We'll have a couple treadmills. And then when you go upstairs, we will have a yoga room, a beautiful yoga room upstairs. So all kinds of activities that will happen right there at the center. Meditation, yoga, high-intensity boot camp style classes, open gym, and you know, the clubhouse as well.
And becoming a member, what does it take to become a member?
We have a membership questionnaire on our website, recoveryfitness.org, and it's just as simple as that. Our programs are free, and they're open to anyone that has 48 hours of continuous sobriety. So we welcome family members, community supporters, those who choose to live drug and alcohol free. All are welcome.
Recoveryfitness.org
yes.
is the website if you want to check it out. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and hear from Tad McNulty, who is a member. Mary Beth Nally has two sons, and we're going to talk about what they are learning and what this community has meant. And we'll make sure you're all set for Monday, a big day in the recovery community here in Rochester. Yana Cashper, Sean Smith, co-founders of Rockcovery Fitness. It's all coming up next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Rochester Music Hall of Fame gets ready for its sixth annual induction ceremony. That's coming up this weekend at the Eastman Theater. We're going to meet some of the inductees, including Joe Beard, Gary Lewis, Samuel Adler, and more. We're going to hear about how the choices were made and the hit makers who are going into this class for Rochester's Music Hall of Fame. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. How many members, Sean, so far for Rockcovery Fitness? How many members do you have now?
At least 1,000, I would say, or over.
Okay, so 1,000 or more members, a lot more than the dozen or so on that initial hike in February of 2015. The community has grown, and one of the people in the community is Tad McNulty, who, how did you come to Rockcovery, Tad?
When I was at the Nielsen House, Sean actually showed up. I remember one time talking about the rock climbing and everything, and everything I wanted to do, because I like working out and everything else. And so we had an event one time, the Nielsen House took us there, and I've been coming there ever since.
All right, so this is, maybe 6 months ago or so, something like that?
Yeah,
so you've been doing that for 6 months, and why don't you take me back a little bit through your own story, your own story of recovery and addiction.
I started using when I was 15 years old. I drank, smoked pot and cigarettes all in the same day. And I started doing coke when I was 17. and I just kind of used ever since. Mm-hmm. Until
where'd you grow up?
Wayne County.
Mm-hmm. And were drugs pretty present? I mean, were they around a lot? Did you feel pressure to do it? Were you bored? I mean, what was the reason that you remember deciding you wanted to do that?
My parents were getting divorced, and we were losing the house and everything. And you started using to avoid all those feelings and emotions.
Okay. And by the time you are, what, I guess 18, 19, did you work after school? What did you do when high school was over?
My father owned a landscaping business for like 30-something years.
Okay.
And so I just started working for him.
Still using, I assume, at the time.
Yes.
Did he know that?
He knew I smoked weed and stuff like that. And as time went, he knew I was using pills and stuff, but it's kind of down the road.
Okay. And so when you end up with pills, what do you mean by pills? What exactly?
Like Oxycontin. Yep. Okay. And stuff like that, painkillers.
And do you move on to that as a choice? I mean, are you thinking, I want something stronger? You know, what just made you end up taking those?
Well, smoking weed every day and even drinking once in a while, just it wasn't enough. And I tried Oxycontin one time and like, wow, I really like this. I wish I could get more of this. And then eventually you just keep doing more and more until it's hard to stop.
Okay. And how did you pay for that? I mean, that gets to be pretty expensive, right?
Just I had worked and I had my own business landscaping for like 6 years mm-hmm. off of my dad's business. And so I had some money, and my dad would always help me out, like with rent and stuff. I needed help.
Okay. Do you remember how many pills a day were you doing?
I only did like one or two, but it's minimizing it. It still led me to other stuff.
Okay. So what was it that changed for you? What was it that led you to be a person in recovery?
Well, my dad passed away 3 years ago, and I started using heroin really bad. And I lost everything. I lost a house, cars, motorcycles, boat. I had a lot of stuff, and I lost all of it. And I ended up homeless. And I didn't think there was anything out there that was going to help me at all. And I just kept using, and eventually to the point where I ended up in jail. And then I ended up on drug court, and that's where I started getting sober.
All right. I think this is important point here. Drug court in Rochester here? Or
yes.
Okay. You know, and that goes back the better part of two decades now. You hear a lot about drug treatment courts. It's not perfect. Not everyone who goes into drug court ends up in recovery, but the rate is remarkably better than people who are simply locked up for these various offenses. And for you, when you were in drug court, were you thinking, I'll do whatever they tell me to do just to kind of satisfy them, or did you think I have to stop? I can't do this anymore.
I knew I couldn't do it anymore. Yeah. They tell me in meetings and stuff that when you go back out, it only gets worse. And I can't even imagine what that would be like. And so I just I don't know. It just wasn't a choice for me.
Okay. When you were in drug court going through that, that's when you had been doing heroin, right?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, everything I read, Ted, is that it's really tough. That when heroin gets a hold of you, it's very, very difficult. How are you doing? I mean, everyone on this table was saying how much they admire you. You look great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Recovery Fitness helped me tremendously. Go on there every day and helps keep me sober. Just keeping in contact with people through recovery and positive people is important for me. And sometimes even in recovery, people get negative or they should cause drama, and I have to stay away from that. And every time I go to Recovery Fitness, it's very uplifting and just stay so positive all the time.
Are you in like the best shape of your life?
Yes.
I mean, I didn't know you growing up, but you look pretty fit. Doesn't it feel awesome, by the way?
It feels great being outside too, and I love being outdoors and hiking and all that. So it's an amazing thing.
And so, as much as recovery is, you know, it's an ongoing process. It's a grind. Are you an optimist now that this is your path, that you're going to stay in recovery, that this is your future?
Yes. It was hard in the beginning because of my family. They didn't they weren't really there before, and now I actually have a relationship with my family today and stuff like that.
That's great.
And it just feels really good just to have that.
That's really great. Talking to Tad McNulty, who's a Rock Cover member, and Maribeth Nally is here as well. And Maribeth is a mother of three sons, two in recovery.
Right.
Maribeth, how did you hook up with these guys? How did you get to know them?
Well, my oldest son was in the throes of a heroin addiction about 5 years ago, and was basically homeless and finding places to sleep and stay. He was married at the time, but his wife had asked him to leave, and we knew we couldn't have him in the house. One night he asked if he could come over, and I said, you can under one condition. You need to sit on the couch and watch the CNN Hero Awards with me, which is one of my favorite shows. It so happened that Scott Strode was being nominated for a CNN Hero Award. And I watched his mom in the audience, and I heard his story. And I looked at my son and I said, this could be you one day. You know, this could be our story. And
what's the story for the audience members who don't know it?
The story is that Scott was in a throes of an addiction, and I don't know exactly how long, but he chose to stop and start Phoenix Multisport out in Denver, Colorado. So he became my hero. It was possible for him. Maybe it would be possible for my son. Things went downhill considerably for my son after that. He was in and out of our house. And finally, we had set up a contract in order for him to live at the house. And it was clear the weekend of the Boston Marathon, the marathon of the bombing, that he had broken contract. So on the day that I was leaving for the marathon, I put everything out in the garage, cried 6 hours to Boston, didn't know what I'd find when I got back. Came back on that Monday, and there was an appointment with the counselor on Tuesday that we were all supposed to keep, and he wouldn't answer his phone. And I tried, and I tried, and I tried, and finally he answered, and I said, I'm going to the appointment. And he showed up. And he tells me now the only reason he showed up was because he thought, after hearing about the bombing, that maybe he would never see me again. So he wanted confirmation I was still with him. And he made the decision that day to go into recovery. And we made the calls that we needed to make. Call after call came up empty. There were no beds to put him in, even though he was ready to go. So we made the decision, my husband and I, to take the week off from work, and we would stay with him. We heard that there was possibly a bed in a week, and we would detox him at home and then take him to the facility. Towards the end of that week, we kept calling, seeing if a bed would open up a little bit earlier. And this was an answer that we had gotten from someone from a facility. When I told him we were detoxing him at home, she said, you know, off the record, I'm just telling you that if you do that and he arrives at the facility and there isn't enough in his system, your insurance is not likely to pay for it.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm saying to her, so you're telling me to let him go back out on the street and risk losing him because of the insurance? And she said, I'm not telling you to do that. I'm just telling you that that's likely to happen. And sure enough, we went down an hour and a half away from Rochester. He went through the process. They absolutely agreed that he needed to be there. We waited another hour and a half for them to contact the insurance, and they came back in the room and they told us he wasn't sick enough. And I looked at our son and we said, what do we do now? Do you want to come back to Rochester, do outpatient? And he looked at his father and I and he said, I can't do that. I have to stay. And so you take out your credit card and you put it down on the table and you gamble that this is going to work and that this money that you're willing to spend is going to, you know, be the answer. And then we left him there. And he's been in recovery now for 4 years. His marriage has survived and he has a beautiful 2-year-old daughter.
Wow. It's an amazing story. And I know it's the best money you ever spent.
Absolutely.
But are you amazed that our system would do that to families?
It's it's incomprehensible. It is. And people just don't realize. Many insurance companies will pay for 14 days. I actually looked up today. It takes 21 to 60 days, 66 days to just break a habit. You don't want to smoke. You don't want to eat potato chips. You don't want to, you know, whatever. 66 days. They'll pay for 14 to beat a heroin or a, you know, alcohol addiction. It's unbelievable.
What are we
doing?
We
should be ashamed.
What are we doing?
And actually, one more point. By keeping him home for a week, we really saved the insurance. Because had he gone and there had been a bed, it would have taken a week for him to detox at that facility, lost all the program material that he would be getting because he wouldn't be ready to process it. So even in doing that, it wasn't enough.
A whole separate conversation, Mary Beth, is why the insurance system is set up the way it is. Mm-hmm. Because what your son is dealing with is, I mean, I don't have to tell you. I mean, we could do a show probably every day this year. People in this community struggling with opioids, heroin. That problem has metastasized in unbelievable ways in recent years. And yet we still have insurance set up in a way that is absolutely unrealistic and frankly looks like it's determined to help people fail. But what a tremendous success story. And your son is doing well then.
He's doing very well. That's very proud of him.
And the Scott Strode story is so interesting because it's kind of like we've got our own versions right here, right?
Absolutely.
With Sean and Yana. You know, this is Rochester's version of that. And so when did you meet them and how did that relationship start?
So I think on Facebook I saw someone posting something about Rockcovery and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this sounds just like the Phoenix Multisport. And so I contacted Yana and my middle son and I met her for breakfast and I just said, what can I do? How can I help? You know, I was so excited, and I'm just thrilled to be a part of this.
And are your sons going? Are they involved?
They are not. They are very physically fit. They are big volleyball players. That is their outlet. But they are totally supportive.
Sure.
Proud of my connection. So they're doing it their own way, but and they may connect sometime in the future. I don't know.
What an amazing mother and woman you are, then. I'm so impressed. I mean, it's really, Yana, I know it probably means a lot to you to have the support of people like Maribeth. What does that mean for Rockcovery?
I think it stands behind, or that's exactly what we stand behind. We want family members. We want the reintegration. We had this one particular hike where a gentleman who had just gotten out of jail for the 15th time, who hasn't spoken to his mom in years and years, and he came on this hike and he invited his mom to come. And we watched as they both walked on this hike talking, laughing, having a great time, and it's really what it's about. You know, recovery is that second chance at making right some of the wrongs that we've made in our lives.
We're talking about Rockcovery Fitness, and the new facility has a grand opening and ribbon-cutting ceremony. That's this coming Monday, 11 a.m. It's formerly a firehouse at 1035 Dewey Avenue, and as you heard Sean and Yana telling us earlier this hour, outfitted with all kinds of great equipment. It's going to be a great space for people to come in, have a cup of coffee, but also on, as Yana pointed out, on days that are, you know, sort of triggering days or difficult days, New Year's Eve, days where there's a lot of potential drinking or usage, that it's a good outlet as well. And they've got roughly 1,000 members already, but they'd love for you to check it out. So that's 1035 Dewey Avenue and the dream coming true on Monday. I want to ask Maribeth just one other question that, you know, you talk about your experience as a parent and trying to figure out what do I do? What is the process like as a parent when you're trying to figure out, literally figure out, do we kick a child out of our house, not knowing what that would mean for them, but knowing that that may be the best chance for them to find a way to get over this or live or get past this or start recovery? I mean, I admire you so much. I can't even imagine what that decision must be like because to some degree, you know, it's easy to stand on the outside and tell people, well, you're enabling or, you know, that's too tough love. I mean, and somewhere in the middle, you're trying to find the right answer. Can you talk about how difficult that is?
Well, it was the hardest decision I ever had to make. And it was a huge risk. I mean, I could have lost him that weekend. But I was losing him anyway. you know, and it's a family disease, and we were all being lost in it. It wasn't until, and it was really soon after I found out how bad his addiction was, that I began to get help for myself. And I think that in some ways saved us all, because my son said, well, both sons say, you know, by example, by watching me take care of myself, gave them permission to focus on themselves and to release some of the guilt of, you know, what they were doing to me. So we both had separate kinds of journeys to go on. And the healthier I got, it seemed the healthier they got, you know. I had a support person say to me, and this was a really defining moment for me, you need to remember these are not bad kids trying to be good. These are sick kids trying to be well. That was huge for me, because in that moment, I was able to release the shame that I was carrying. I lived in an alcoholic household. I was ashamed most of my life. The last thing I wanted was to go through this again with a family member. You know, what did I do wrong? What could I have done differently? The minute I recognized it for what it is, it's a disease. And I saw it as, you know, a sickness that they were trying to recover from, everything shifted for me. You know, I could be the mother then that I was really meant to be. And the other thing that helped was my willingness to be vulnerable and share my story, because the minute you start to do that, you know, it not only helps you, but it helps every person that hears your story. I mean, it gets it out of the closet. We begin to be healthy and begin to heal once we start to share.
Every person in recovery has a different story. Every recovery story is unique in its own way. But I think it's so valuable to hear Maribeth talk about her kids, the decisions she had to make, those difficult moments. You heard Sean mention earlier that, you know, in some ways it was your family grabbing you saying, you can't do this anymore. If they hadn't done that, do you think you'd be sitting here today? I mean,
no.
In the same kind of state?
No, I don't. I don't think I would have found my way into treatment had it not been for my family members. And, you know, if not for treatment, I wouldn't have made it to recovery.
And what do you say then for any listener who knows someone in addiction, maybe a family member, maybe a child, or eventually will, who, that's not an easy conversation to have. You know, you love them, you respect them, you know, you don't want to infringe on their privacy. Maybe you know about a problem, maybe you don't know how deep it goes, maybe you suspect but you're not certain, and you're nervous about having that conversation. What would you say to them?
Have that uncomfortable conversation, be honest. As soon as you can get it out in the open, you can start dealing with it. Whether they're in denial about it or not, at least you can tell them that, hey, I'm concerned about your well-being, your health and your welfare, and I want to see you get help. And if they're unwilling to do that, you know, like Maribeth said, you have to take care of yourself, which is a really hard thing to do. Sending a kid out into the street now with the heroin that's out there, it's scary. It's really scary.
Ted, what about you? What would you say to people who eventually will have to confront the decision on what to do about a friend or a family member who may be addicted? You know, I mean, I know you had some struggles with your own family around you, and I'm glad to hear that things sound like they're really improved there. But if you love someone and you're worried about their addiction, what would your message be to them?
I think you should talk to them and try to help them. A lot of my family, personally, they knew they weren't going to help me. Like when I was out there using, nobody was going to help me. I had to get through it myself somehow, some way, and find my own way through it, because it was just nobody was going to stop me from getting what I wanted to get. So it's really tough for family members, because mm-hmm. my mom and my sister had to watch me just keep using, and they knew there was nothing they could do, and they wanted to help me, but they didn't want to enable me either into getting more stuff or whatever, so they just kind of stopped contacting me a lot of times, and it's tough. So if you can talk to them, reach out to them, that's what I would do. If you can't, sometimes you have to let them find their own way, as hard as it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly the struggle that Maribeth talked about. And Yana, for you now, when you look in this community, man, the last is 3 years especially, it feels like heroin, opioids especially. I mean, addiction runs the gamut of all these different things, but heroin and opioids, huge problem here. Do you focus on your work, or do you ever think about the larger problem about why are we seeing more of this, particularly now? Have you thought about that?
Absolutely. I do quite a bit of advocacy work. Mm-hmm. I'm engaged in some statewide as well as nationwide initiatives in the recovery movement. I think it's the stigma of the disease of addiction is so strong. You know, a lot of treatment providers, people in recovery are used to this bubble, the safe little bubble. But when we step outside of that bubble, there's just so much hate. You know, and I think some people try to sugarcoat it, try to criminalize their way out of it. There are no treatment beds. There are no inpatient treatment beds in Rochester. Most days, there's 2 to 3 week wait lists, and you're told to just survive out there. And we can't keep sugarcoating it. So I think being honest, sharing stories is so important because we're losing an entire generation. We haven't even hit the peak of this epidemic. We're not even there. It's going to rock our worlds in such ways that we haven't even imagined today.
And so policymakers, at the very least, when you talk about the lack of beds, that sounds mm-hmm. like something that maybe could be addressed.
Absolutely. Funding. There is minimal funding to substance use disorders and recovery organizations. There needs to be funding. We need to create open beds for people. That window of opportunity is so small. When somebody wants treatment, it needs to be there. You know, we don't tell someone who has cancer or heart disease, you got to hold on. You know, stop your heart attack for another week and we'll get you in. And it needs to be treated that same way.
That's such a good point. I mean, I know, Maribeth, you can relate to that.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I was lucky enough that, you know, as Tad said, both my boys got to a point where they came to us and they said, you know, I can't do this anymore. You know, so that was half the battle. But it was darn hard getting both of them a place to go in a timely manner before their courage waned and they decided they couldn't go through with it.
I don't even want to think about it, but it does make you wonder how many people have been in that position willing to say, all right, this is too far, I can't do this anymore, and then either there's no bed or there's no insurance and that window closes.
Absolutely.
And did you ever kind of get your head around why your sons started using, why you think more people today in this country, wherever it is, Rochester, rural areas, all across the country, are turning to heroin, turning to opioids?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, they're genetically predisposed. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a family history of it. Kind of skipped a generation for my family, but we always had those conversations in our house. We were not the house that had the keg, you know. We were not the house that, you know, allowed the kids. I mean, because we were always worried that this was a possibility. I don't know. I don't know. I think depression is a big factor in our family as well. And I think, you know, it's easier to self-medicate than to, you know, have the courage to seek out, you know, a counselor or therapy or whatever. So, you know, and they were males. I think they were at risk just by their, you know, genetic makeup, you know. So I don't know. I try not to think about that too much because you go, woulda, coulda, shoulda, what could we have done differently?
Sure.
We loved them and still do and are proud of them. We did the best we could, and it happens. And that's what I want parents to know, that, you know, it's not your fault, you know. Let that go and just, you know, jump in and see what you can do from here.
Focus on the work in front of you and look at the success stories. Real quick here, Yana. Go ahead.
All I wanted to say was the pharmaceutical industry has really flooded our community with opioids, with various medications, and that for many people is the start of their addiction.
Yeah, and I think you go back 20 years, pain management, those kind of things. I mean, there's a lot that has happened that I think we could go back and change, but doesn't matter. We can't go back and change. The question is, what are you going to do now? So there's policy, there's ideas, and then there's places like Rockcovery Fitness. Rockcoveryfitness.org, Monday, May 1st. That's this Monday, 11 a.m. for their ribbon cutting. That's out at Dewey Avenue, 1035 Dewey Avenue for their new facility. And you want to check it out? They'll give you tours. They'll let you see it. Talk to their members. Talk to Sean and Yana. Congratulations to both of you. 3 years recovery and Rockcovery's grand opening. Awesome stuff. Thank you both for being here. Really appreciate that.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Tad, really admire you. Good luck to you. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
And Maribeth, continued success to all of your family. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Short break. More Connections next.